Is he my prince? Is he the toad? Waiting, wondering, is getting too old. I'm gonna let down my hair, slide up my skirt. Welcome to the Shame Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual.
And this is Veronica Monet of the Shame Free Zone. It's Monday evening. I'm still waiting for spring to arrive, but now I've given up on that. I'm just hoping for summer. looking at fairly clear skies here in Northern California, but on the horizon is yet another storm. There's supposed to be thunderstorms tomorrow. And wouldn't you know it, tonight's guest, Serena McKenzie, is up in Seattle, and she had a beautiful day. Welcome to the Shame-Free Zone, Serena.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So I guess I'm going to have to move to Seattle if I want to see some sun.
Well, don't feel bad. This is like the first fabulous spring day we've had yet, so we're about 6 weeks behind ourselves.
Yeah, I guess we all are. You know, I'm actually coming up your way in July.
Oh.
I'm going to be teaching a workshop with Terry Chalky on the 13th and something over at the Center for Sex Positive Culture that weekend.
Awesome. So I'll be there.
I'm hoping you and I finally get a chance to meet face-to-face because we've been talking over the phone now for, I think, about 6 months, but we haven't actually met in person.
Well, we met a few years back. We've met. It's been quite some time, but we have met once.
Oh, God, I'm so embarrassed. It happens to me so many times. Okay, how and when did we meet? Was this at one of my events?
We met at a Poly Living Conference in, 2007 or something.
Yes, I did a workshop up there.
Mm-hmm. It's in San Francisco.
Can't even remember the name of the workshop. I just know my book was still relatively new then.
Yes, so. I think it was on bonobos. I think that's what it was on.
That sounds like me.
Yes.
Talking about bonobos. Was I any good?
Yes, it was fantastic, of course.
Oh, you have to say that. Oh, it's a total setup. Okay, so let's tell our listeners something about you. Serena, you are a naturopathic physician.
Mm-hmm.
And you just established a new medical center. Is that true?
Well, no, I've actually been at the medical clinic that I'm at now for about 5 years. So the center itself is not new, but I specialize in sexual medicine, and so there's new programs within my sexual medicine specialty that are developing, quite a few different ones that are at different phases of development. But there's new programs within a pre-established clinic that are coming to fruition at various phases over the next year.
And you're also ASEX certified, mm-hmm. which is like, that is the best certification in sexology. Can you tell our listeners just a little bit about ASEX? Stands for?
Sure. Yeah, ASEX stands for, let's see if I can get it straight, American Association of Sex Therapists, Educators, and Counselors, and maybe
yes,
not in that order.
Educators, therapists, and counselors.
There we go. Yeah,
yeah.
Some in order. I can never quite get the acronym quite right. But so they're a national organization that certifies individuals of these different types. And for myself, I'm certified as a sex counselor because I'm a physician. The therapy certification is for psychologists, and then there's the educator certification as well. And anyway, it's just a really great organization that is fabulous. It's national, but there also are a lot of members that are international, and so that's just one of the sexual professional organizations that I belong to. There's quite a few other ones in our country that are also fantastic, but
ASEX is pretty rigorous, though.
They are. They're great, and there's just a large variety of different providers who belong to it. I think the bulk of it are therapists, sex therapists, but there's also, like myself, physicians who specialize in sexual medicine. There's a lot of educators. There's a lot of people who are just, generally speaking, involved in really great, sex-positive type endeavors, whether it's writing books or doing education or, practicing clinically. It's just a really neat organization of people.
Well, and speaking of, physicians. Now, when I was getting certified as a sex educator through San Francisco Sex Information, one of the things they told us is that most physicians get about 12 hours of sex education, and the bulk of that is focused on procreation and STDs.
Oh, absolutely. I would say, 12 hours is generous estimate. I would say less than an hour for certain studies have reported less than an hour in the entire 4 years of medical school. So it's incredibly poor. And yes, if there is conversation about sex in medical school, for the most part, it is about gynecology or urology or, you know, getting the anatomy straight in the mind of a medical student. But any actual sexual function beyond fertility or reproduction or menstruation or, you know, traditional medical dysfunction, there's just almost no conversation whatsoever. And that's pretty uniform in any type of medical school that you look into. It's quite remarkable, in fact, and it does create most physicians having absolutely no skills or comfort level being able to talk to patients about sex, which is unfortunate because sex affects so many aspects of our lives. And it's true. Physicians have next to no education in sexuality in really any fashion.
It's really sad. That's even a more shocking statistic than one that I had been exposed to. So, but it does explain a lot. I have heard some of the most bizarre things coming from the medical profession when they're intersecting with sexual issues. For instance, when I was working as an escort and I was married, went to see my gynecologist, and I wanted to get tested for every sexually transmitted infection known to man, and I did that every year. That was the way, you know, that was just my practice. Every year I got tested for everything. And the physician that I was seeing happened, and I'm only going to mention her race because she made an issue out of it, not because I did, but she happened to be an older Asian woman, and she was very disturbed by the fact that I would want to get tested because I was married. I, of course, did not feel at all comfortable telling her that I was an escort. So I said, well, you seem to be making an assumption that my husband's faithful. I mean, how would I know? And she looked at me and she says, oh, Asian men don't cheat on their wives.
Right.
And I just thought, that is the most inane thing I've ever heard. Not to mention that my own personal experience was I actually had a lot of married Asian clients. But unbelievable. How do you get through medical school with that level of racism and ignorance in operation? Just blew my mind.
Yeah, well, you know, I can't comment so much on the racism part, you know, but I can say the ignorance in sexuality it's quite profound. I mean, there have been a number of studies that have looked at why physicians are so inadequately prepared in clinical practice to speak to people about sex. And, you know, the number one cited reason why physicians don't even ask, or if it's brought up by the patient, why they shut the conversation down, is that they just feel so inherently uncomfortable with the entire conversation. And there's also a lot of concerns from medical professionals that they will be sued if they ask questions of a sexual nature, that a patient will misinterpret the reason for the line of questioning. And one of the third most common reasons cited is that physicians say they have absolutely no idea what to do with the information, even if they have a comfort level in sexuality and they feel comfortable discussing with their patient what that patient's concern is. Most physicians will say, well, I have no idea what to do with a sexual complaint. I have no training. There's no FDA-approved treatment for women, for example, for some of the most common sexual dysfunctions in women. So physicians are kind of just flailing in the wind on all sides. Like, they're not comfortable. Even if they are, they have no resources. They don't know what to do or who to talk to.
Right.
Or, you know, there's no medication to prescribe in the next 30 seconds to make a sexual problem go away. So they kind
so
of just
do with it.
Yeah. So what do you do with it? So most doctors are just like, well, we'll just leave it.
And I have had clients. You know, I work with clients over the phone and in person in my office now since 2004 as a sexologist and a sex educator. And also an anger management specialist, so I'm actually combining sexology and anger management I actually don't think anybody else is doing that. But it's just sad. They will sometimes, my clients have talked about their sexual issues with their physician and just been horrified and stigmatized and embarrassed by the response, because it is awkward oftentimes.
It's sad, and then that oftentimes just makes the problem itself even worse. And
yes.
You know, I get a ton of referrals from other physicians. Gynecologists, urologists, people, you know, practicing specialties that you would think, even above and beyond just a general practitioner, you would think that a gynecologist or urologist would have at least some additional training or comfort level. But
right.
Most of the referrals I get are from other gynecologists. They're like, thank goodness somebody else wants to talk about sex because I don't want to.
Yes, and you know, it's interesting too, because I'm sure that, you know, I don't know. This is in the literature if it's that common yet. But are you familiar with the AFA, the anterior fornix erogenous zone?
The what? Say that again. I'm sorry.
AFA, anterior fornix erogenous zone.
No, not terribly familiar.
Okay, that's kind of a new thing. Came out last year.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually, if you look at gynecological diagrams, it is marked, but it's just considered the anterior fornix. So that would be a place on the anterior portion of the vaginal wall, which is adjacent to the tip of the cervix. So, and that spot has been identified as a place that can create quite a bit of lubrication and actually lead to orgasm in women who might otherwise be anorgasmic.
Well, see, that's such an interesting topic, because women can become orgasmic from just about anywhere, really. I mean, there's so much fascinating research out there just on that topic alone that it's amazing. You know, I think women can become orgasmic at just about any point of their body if they deem that an erogenous zone for themselves, you know? So
well,
there are
sure.
some really great studies about not just specific areas in the vagina, but all kinds of stimulation that can cause orgasm.
Absolutely. But for some women, some of the usual suspects like the G-spot or even the clitoris are not necessarily working for them.
Yep.
If they're able to stimulate the A-spot, they might be able to get over that resistance or past that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. No, I'm not even familiar with that specific spot, but I think it's fantastic, because what I love about the female anatomy is that there's just so much opportunity for
seriously, though, I mean, that applies to both males and females, and we don't even need erogenous zones to achieve orgasm, because it is possible to have an orgasm just by breathing yourself into one.
Well, exactly. Like, you know, Beverly Whipple, who's done, like, you know, decades and decades, I'm sure you're familiar with her, on orgasm research.
Her book changed my life back in the 80s.
Yeah, right? I mean, and she's still out there doing it. She was
for
at
the
a conference.
For the listeners who don't know, Beverly Whipple authored The G-Spot.
Yes, and many, many books since then. But she was at this conference recently that I was at, and she's done just this amazing research with MRI studies of women who are in the category of having an orgasm without manual stimulation. And the biochemistry and the brain neurology is identical in women who have clitoral versus G-spot versus, I'm sure, the spot that you were referencing, versus no stimulation at all. Like, the biochemistry is identical in all of those situations. And I just find that so, so fascinating, you know, and just incredibly interesting in terms of what biochemically is going on for women who are having an orgasm, and what implications that has for a woman who cannot orgasm, because there's a lot of women who have never had an orgasm and who really struggle with that. So I think it's very interesting.
It's still a really prevalent problem.
It is.
It really is. I don't know what your take on it is, but I have been experimenting with the whole idea of repressed emotions, and in particular with women, I think anger, because that's such a taboo emotion for women to show. And I actually started noticing this in some of my workshops, because I teach a sex coaching workshop where people actually will come as couples. They have to pre-register as a couple. I don't let people come in and hook up in my classes. But if they come with their partner, then they can usually it's like a 4-hour class. The first 2 hours are fully clothed and it's problem solving the relationship issues. People are working on their emotions and how to communicate and connect. Mm-hmm. And then the last 2 hours, they will actually be engaging in sex with their partner. Mm-hmm. And what I noticed is that if I was able to help women go on this journey to get in touch with their anger, oftentimes they were able to either reconnect with female ejaculation, which they might not have been able to do for 6 months or a year, mm-hmm. or might actually female ejaculate for the first time in their life.
Mm-hmm. And I don't doubt it. I don't doubt it. The emotional environment is just so critical for a positive sexual experience. And, you know, I think anger is huge. I think resentment is one of the biggest emotional components that I see in women in terms of sexual dysfunction towards, you know, with a specific partner. And I also think that for women, orgasm is a very vulnerable state for not all women, but for many. And if there is this inability to orgasm, what I'm often seeing is that there's an inability to be vulnerable or just intimate or comfortable in their own body in an intimate situation with a partner. And so I think there's just so many things that are relevant, you know, and there isn't any one specific equation that this is why, you know, a woman will not orgasm. I mean, there's also so many sexual side effects from medications that's a huge entire other conversation. I mean, a lot of women are orgasmic, and then antidepressants, for example, are very common category of medications that I work with that cause anorgasmia, and women are no longer able to orgasm no matter what they do. Not all of them, but some women on antidepressants have that side effect. And so that's a big piece of my medical world, too, is managing not just
the
emotions.
Let's talk about that a little bit, because that actually intersects with my work around anger. And oftentimes I will, you know, bring out the fact that, yes, you know, you could have a serotonin imbalance and actually need medication. There could be other reasons why you would need medication, but sometimes I think physicians are too quick to try to prescribe people antidepressants and not usually with a real interest in how that's going to affect their sexual response.
Exactly. And it's so true. It's so true. Antidepressants are one of the most commonly prescribed medications in our country. I mean, 1 in 10 Americans are on an antidepressant. I would say even higher than that, but that's statistically what is said. And, you know, the antidepressants are a fabulous category of medications in certain circumstances. You know, they can save lives 100%. But they are, I believe, very commonly overprescribed, and individuals are not counseled on the side effects, and some individuals have a really hard time getting off them after they've been on them. There's just a whole plethora of just kind of complications, and that's true for any medication. There's pros and cons at any turn, and I think, unfortunately, antidepressants have, some would say, almost unanimous sexual side effects. And not, and again, I wouldn't say 100%. Nothing's ever all or none, but it is by far the most common sexual side effect medication that I work with. And, you know, they did a really huge review study, I think it was in 2009 or early 2010, that showed for mild to moderate depression, antidepressants, none of them were better than placebo. And this was a huge study that was done, and it was very...
None of them were better than placebo?
No, more better than placebo for mild to moderate.
That's terrible.
I know, it's terrible. And, you know, for major depression, that did show some statistically significant improvement in mood. But for mild to moderate depression, I mean, and this is common knowledge. This is, like, very large-scale data that psychiatrists and physicians are all aware of. And yet still, we prescribe them. I mean, I prescribe them when they're needed. I'm not opposed to them inherently, but I think the appropriate prescription of an antidepressant is really the goal, and they are given out like candy in our culture. And the side effects, including sexual, are very predominant. And, you know, unfortunately, there's not a ton of things to be done. There's definitely things that I try. There's some few small studies in Viagra with women who have sexual side effects due to an antidepressant. Some really small studies, and I don't see that work very often. You know, there's just not a ton to do. Of course, improving the relationship and behavioral modification and, you know, stimulation. I mean, there's definitely things to be done. But for some women, the only thing that really, really ultimately helps is to get off of the medication. And that's not always an option. You know, if someone is in major depression or major anxiety state, they don't want to have sex either, right? So you get kind of in between a rock and a hard place with that situation, because the condition itself has sexual side effects, but so does the treatment, right?
Right.
So it's... It's complicated. I spend a lot of my clinical practice kind of navigating through that because so many individuals are on antidepressants, whether that be for depression. They also can work very well for anxiety, and it's really just a pros and cons juggling act of like, well, how well is this medication working? Because it absolutely does work for some people in terms of symptom resolution.
Now, what do you, Serena, what do you think about some of the connections that have been asserted between repressed anger and depression? Do you think there's any connection between those?
Oh, absolutely, 100%. I think repressed anger, repressed a lot of emotions represent the depressive state. And I think that's another huge conversation piece in terms of our culture and how we manage what we call depression, because a lot of times what we consider a depressive state is a completely appropriate response to a life circumstance. And our medical culture is very quick to take an experience that a patient will state of sadness or anxiety or boredom or fear and give that a diagnosis of depression when, in actuality, that is a completely appropriate response to a situation that has made someone very angry or a situation that has made them very sad. And I think we're not very good in our community of exploring what those emotions are. We're much quicker to just try to shut them down and to diagnose them as a disorder instead of explore that as our life experience, you know. And so I think anger, absolutely, so many things. To me, a lot of people are in a state of depression because they're disconnected from their true selves, whether that is, you know, whether that is expressed in anger or all these other various emotions. I think ultimately there is often so much value in exploring the source of the emotions that they're experiencing. And, you know,
a lot of support for that.
There's
oftentimes,
not.
You know, what I see even in some of the self-improvement movements that have become very popular seem to, to try to get people to kind of forget about the past, keep, you know, move on, don't dwell, you know, this, and obviously, I think, you know, dwelling sounds very negative, ruminating sounds very negative, but actually having an ability to process those feelings, sometimes it seems like that gets cast in a negative light by the use of terminology, which suggests that you need to get over it.
Yeah.
And people are so busy trying to pretend they've gotten over things, they don't really get a chance to process and actually move through it.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's just not a lot of skill sets that are offered for individuals of not only how to move through it, but how to integrate, you know, whatever life circumstances provoking these emotions into something that's positive and that can move you forward to the next place. And I think we also really lack a support for self-exploration and self-identification and who am I and why am I here? You know, all these big life questions that are cliche but really important. You know, what I see in my practice is a lot of people just are not, they're not living a life that they enjoy. You know, they're not in a satisfying marriage. They don't enjoy their job. They are very stressed. They work too much. They're not taking care of themselves. They're not exercising. They're not sleeping. You know, they have a bowel movement once every 2 weeks. I mean, I see this all day, every day, you know. And to me, when patients come to me with a sexual dysfunction and they say, well, I have no interest in sex, and it's like, well, you have no interest in anything in your life, so why would you have interest in sex? You know, this is a bigger picture than just
than just sex and
just the diagnosis of depression, you know. And it's complicated. These aren't things that go away with a pill, and they aren't things that change overnight, but they are things that change when people start asking those really important questions for themselves, which we all have to ask ourselves, right?
Absolutely. Now, let's talk about people who perhaps have to take an antidepressant, you know, for whatever reason, or at least maybe short term.
Yeah.
How would you help them advocate for their best sex life with their physician? One of the things I tell them is you're going to have to go back over and over again and ask them to change the prescription and change the dosage until they get it right. And I'm wondering if you agree with that or if you have any tips that would enlarge upon that.
Well, there are different medications that have lower sexual side effects than others, for sure. And so that's the first place to start. Wellbutrin, for example, is an antidepressant that has the lowest sexual side effects, generally speaking. And again, this is just going to be a very individualized conversation that someone needs to have with their physician, because there are a lot of circumstances where it's completely appropriate and necessary to be on an antidepressant, possibly very long term, possibly lifelong. I have a lot of patients who have been on antidepressants for decades, and they've tried to get off, they've done therapy, they've asked all those big life questions. There may just be a biochemical imbalance, and the medication is very helpful, and they're very grateful for that, and that's just established. That needs to be there, you know. So then the next question is, well, you know, what type of symptoms are individuals experiencing? Wellbutrin, for example, is better at treating depressive symptoms and anxiety symptoms. So why is the medication being prescribed? And then sometimes lowering the dose of the medication, if that's appropriate, if that still manages symptoms, can help reduce sexual side effects. So going from, you know, 20 milligrams of Celexa down to 15, sometimes that can make a small amount of difference. That's enough. That's another option. There are a few other antidepressants that have lower sexual side effects. So it's kind of that conversation of, like, well, what are the symptoms? What can we do? And what can we work with here? You know, so that's really where to start, is just to make sure that you're on the best medication for you and what the symptoms are that you're having that possibly have a lower sexual side effects. I know that there's some suggestion that Prostique, which is a newer antidepressant, may have some sexual side effect reduction for some people, but honestly, I haven't seen that a ton. Sometimes adding Wellbutrin to an established medication makes a small difference for people. So say they're on Zoloft and they're having a lot of sexual side effects with that. Adding Wellbutrin onto it occasionally mediates that a little bit. So there's a lot of kind of nuances and juggling that can be done. But, you know, you want to do that carefully, and you want to do that under the supervision of a physician in case a medication change doesn't work for you. You know, you want to make sure that you've got someone who's managing that for you. So I always encourage patients to never go off on their own without talking to someone first about it.
Right, because that can actually create more problems.
Once your brain chemistry's gotten
used to that. So if I were to summarize that for the listeners, it sounds like you agree that you need to kind of be your best advocate and be persistent with the doctor, because they're probably more interested in treating the depression than actually making sure you've got a sex life. Would that be right?
True, yes, true. And I think, you know, a really good physician, no matter what specialty they practice, are good listeners and are willing and interested to hear what's really going on in people's lives, you know. And that, I think, and I work with amazing physicians of all different specialties, and that's a common quality, you know. And so if that characteristic is not present in a physician-patient relationship, it's okay to find someone who does have that rapport with you, you know. And not all doctors are really there wanting to listen about what's going on. So it's, you know, I always encourage patients to be their own advocate, like you said, and to have a voice and say, you know, this part of this medication is really not working for me, and this is why. And, you know, if this isn't something that you feel knowledgeable about or are willing to discuss, then, you know, it's okay to find another physician who is willing to have that dialogue in a comfortable way. Because, you know, I remind patients, it's like, we work for you as physicians, you know. We're here to help and support you in getting to your best state. And oftentimes it kind of feels the other way around, I think, in patients aren't being heard. And so, you know, I just always try to remind people that if you're not getting that experience, feel, you know, please find it somewhere.
Yeah, the medical profession seems to have originated kind of from the paradigm of being the authority figure.
Yeah.
And patients are just supposed to shut up and do what they're told. And I think we are gradually moving away from that, but it still seems to be a pretty prominent overlay.
It is still there, and, you know, I think a lot of physicians are really good people, and sometimes they really just don't have the answer in terms of how to juggle the medications around. I mean, sexual medicine is a very small specialty, and so it sometimes may be just simply you know, just not knowing. And you can't blame a physician for that if they just don't know, but that you do have the right to find someone who does know or ask them, you know, could you find out? Could you call someone? Could you get some more information about what my options are? Because, you know, it's not working for me that I haven't had an orgasm since the day I started this medication. And,
exactly.
You know, that can have a serious
What kind of a life is that? So, Serena, I want to ask you just a couple questions about what it was that caused you to go into sexology.
Mm-hmm.
And then from that, after we get just a little bit about your background, I want to actually segue into the fact that you've been doing some outreach to sex workers. So to start off, what was it? I mean, was that kind of an uncommon path, it sounds like, since a lot of physicians
Hello?
Don't know much about sex. What created the curiosity or the passion for you?
You know, I've just always thought sex was a fabulous thing, personally. You know, I've always found it to be so fascinating, and there's just so much relevance to it. And I've just personally have had very positive experiences throughout my lifetime, and was fortunate to be raised in an environment that was very sex positive, and which is a rare and unusual gift in childhood, definitely.
No kidding.
So, you know, I think it was just a combination of my environment and just my personality. I find sex to be a very adventurous and wonderful aspect of being human. I mean, to me, it's one of the most profound human experiences that we are gifted with in this lifetime. And so, you know, it just kind of stemmed from that. I've been working in sexuality for about 16 years now, and just have done all different sorts of things in terms of sexual assault advocacy, working with HIV and AIDS in the early 90s when it was a much bigger deal then than it is now, which is wonderful. And just, you know, when I went through medical school, it just became a natural progression after I became a physician to just transform a long-standing involvement in sex education into becoming a sexual medicine physician. So it just kind of translated that way. And as you mentioned, I've been one of the next phases is expanding my work into healthcare for sex workers, which is something that's new for me, and I've been learning a lot about recently, and it's been fantastic. It's been really, really interesting, and I think that's a population that has even more so difficulty, as you were explaining earlier, having respectful healthcare, and that's a shame. That shouldn't be that way. You know, I think what a woman chooses.
How did you become aware of that, I'm wondering?
Well, you know, I have patients. I have patients who are sex workers. How did I become aware of that? You know, I think just working in the sexuality world, and, you know, I have just so many fantastic colleagues and know. So, I mean, in Seattle, as you know, we have a wonderful community here of just a lot of sex positive environments. And so, I don't know, osmosis, I suppose, is how it just kind of came into my view. I can't say there was any specific moment, but.
Did you find any resistance from your colleagues? I mean, you work at a center where there's other physicians in attendance,
mm-hmm.
correct?
Yes, I do. I am business partner.
So, was there any resistance to the idea of reaching out to sex workers?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you ask that. I mean, I think, you know, I work primarily with a gynecologist. I'm business partners with a gynecologist, and she's fantastic and wonderful and doesn't particularly have interest in talking about sex herself, and yet she honors what I do and recognizes my passion for it and my skill in working in this area. And so her attitude is like, you know, okay, go for it. Just because we have a really supportive environment between the two of us. And, you know, some of the other physicians just kind of raised a bit of an eyebrow. But a lot of doctors, when I tell them about the sexual medicine part of my practice, I mean, I'm also a general practitioner, but the sexual medicine practice, they often don't ask questions. It's actually really funny. A lot of people kind of raise an eyebrow and they'll hear about what I do, and then they just quit talking. It's just really funny. So it kind of went like that when I, you know, had the conversation with my colleagues in the clinic that I work in of like, well, this is something that I'm, you know, looking to create some specific programs for. And everyone was supportive and maybe somewhat a little hands-off and kind of like, great, you go for that. let me know how it goes.
Interesting.
Yeah, sure. You know, so, I mean, I think, you know, it's not just the medical community. I mean, one of the interesting facets I find about sex workers is that we have this culture that is just completely dominated by sexuality and sexual messages, most of which are mythical or very confusing and inaccurate. And yet when we have individuals who choose to work in sex as a profession, oftentimes they are just completely condemned and not supported at all, and of course are, you know, legally and in every other way condemned. And I just find that so representative of how dysfunctional our culture is around sex.
They are seemingly incongruent concepts, the idea that somehow or another we can have a lot of sexually explicit imagery and conversations, and at the same time anything that would acknowledge sex as a normal, viable aspect of life becomes suspect and taboo. However,
absolutely,
I actually think that a lot of what's going on, and you can let me know if you agree with this or not, but I think we've actually got a culture which has become very pornographically referential. People are, you know, young people especially are watching a tremendous amount of porn.
Yeah.
I looked at one survey that had found like 65% of the college females were watching online porn on a regular basis.
Yeah.
And of course, 100% of the guys. Okay, 99.9.9, whatever.
Yeah.
Pretty out there. And then there seems to be a lot of addiction to online porn as well. And and what I'm noticing in my office is a lot of women, especially, you know, 40 and younger, who are really aspiring to engage in sexual behaviors that they have seen in pornographic films. Particularly anal sex seems to have become incredibly commonplace, so commonplace that it's often what is done on the very first date.
And
there seems to be this expectation, you know, just kind of pushing it out there, almost like, well, I should be able to orgasm if the guy ejaculates on my back. Why can't I?
Right.
Like, there's no connection to the actual functioning of a female body, or what would turn it on. It just seems like the sex has become completely referenced to pornography, and to the pace, perhaps, of male sexuality, with very, very little connection to female sexuality at all. And that, to me, is still putting sex over in this box separate from the rest of life, not connected to our hearts, not connected to our relationships, not connected even to our the specifics of our anatomy, but kind of rarefied into this fantasy world, which is disembodied and disconnected. And I think any time you start to create connections that have heart and spirit and soul to it, then people get incredibly uncomfortable because they want their sex a la carte.
And that doesn't work. And, you know, a large part of the population I work with are individuals who've been married in a monogamous relationship for a very long time. And, you know, I think pornography is such an interesting topic, and there's definitely some valuable aspects to it, I believe. I mean, one of the most valuable things I see in my practice for pornography is that people are having such poor experiences sexually. They're not enjoying it. A lot of women are experiencing pain or discomfort or, you know, as we were talking earlier, I've never had an orgasm. And I think sex, viewing sex in pornography, depending on the type, can allow for individuals to see people having sex that is fun, you know, and I think that's one of the major draws about pornography for many individuals is seeking for something that is playful or fun or joyful. And of course, not all porn is that way. It really depends on what you're looking at. But that's a lot of what I see people looking for is, like, there are no role models in our culture for healthy sexuality. And it's true that most of pornography is incredibly inaccurate and leaves especially women, but men also, in misperceptions of what a satisfying sexual experience is. And, you know, it's very complicated. And I think that, you know, bringing real-life sexual information into our culture is difficult, very difficult, and there's not often a conversation to easily bring that information into. And so many of my patients just have all these, as you were referencing, incredible misperceptions and wonder, you know, why don't I just orgasm like the minute he looks at me backwards, you know? It's like, well, there's some more anatomy to it than that, you know? And so it is. It's very interesting.
Yeah, and that recent research coming out of Indiana indicated that those women who were achieving orgasm were doing a variety of sexual behaviors during any particular sexual encounter, that just doing intercourse all by itself really wasn't working for anybody.
No, I mean, you know, some statistics that I read is that less than 30% of women can have an orgasm with vaginal penetration alone, that far over anywhere between different studies between 70 and 95% of women need to have clitoral stimulation in order to have an orgasm. And there are some positions that provide clitoral stimulation with intercourse, but most women, the vast majority of women, need to have clitoral stimulation either of their own accord or, you know, a partner stimulating or, you know, some other way. And what I see in my practice is that a lot of women are just not comfortable or not aware or even want to become aware, are still not comfortable touching their own bodies or asking for what they want in a sexual situation. And
well, again, if you're watching pornography, it's very unlikely that the woman in the porno is going to be asking for what she wants. It's much more likely that the scenario will be the guy asks her to do something and she shows a great deal of zeal and relish for that.
Yes. Well, and you know what I think is also important to note is that the men in my office who are working under that context are not happy either, you know?
No.
Even if they are still, if they have no erectile problems, no, you know, are able to orgasm, are having sex in that way without any emotion, it doesn't work for them either. And I think that's all.
And, you know, Serena, one of the things that I have started to see show up in my office is men, 40 and younger, who are looking for permission not to have sex. And they feel really bad about it. They feel like somehow or another they're not measuring up to their imagined ideal of masculinity. And they don't know even how to do it, how to say no to a girl. This is becoming like a new concern. And there's even a movement in Japan. I don't know if you heard about it. They're called herbivores, and which in the Japanese literal translation actually is grass-eating boys. And there's this whole movement in Japan of young men who are not interested in having sex.
Doesn't surprise me, you know, and I mean, what I see medically is that there's a lot of these same population, 40 and younger men, who are starting to develop erectile problems or premature ejaculation or delayed ejaculation, meaning the inability to ejaculate, because there are so many of these factors going on. And, you know, and I try to remind women of that, and especially women who are partnered and married to a man. It's like, you know, it's not working for him either. And, you know, a very common scenario that evolves after many years or decades of marriage is that a woman will be like, well, I don't want to have sex, so I'm just going to lay here, and he can just blow his nose and get it done kind of situation. And, you know, and what I try to, you know, spend a lot of time talking to women about, it's like, well, that's not working for you. You know, obviously they're in my office complaining and concerned about sex. And it's like, but it's not working for your husband either, and I promise you that it's not, because that's not a satisfying sexual experience for a man either. I think women tend to have this misperception that men want to have sex just like porn, and that they want to just have sex and have their orgasm and roll over and go to sleep, and that they're supposed to somehow measure up to that experience, but they don't. And what I think is really important to hear is that it's not measuring up for them either. You know, they're not happy either.
And you know what really is helpful, I refer a lot of my clients to this, is the Comstock films, since, you know, it is a rather pornographic culture. I said, well, then try a different type of porn. Comstock films, are you familiar with them?
Yeah, I'm not familiar with them, but I have multiple websites. Sinclair Institute is one that I refer to, and Sex Smart Films is another one. Betty Dodson's website actually has some really great educational
stuff. Betty Dodson
stuff.
Has some great stuff. And actually, I did a video with my husband years ago for Sinclair, the Better Sex People.
Yeah, so there's great resources, and you know, I spend a lot of time talking to patients about
there
that,
is.
Too.
But
it's
one
like,
of the things that I really like about Comstock Films is that they are, by and large, not all of them, but a lot of the people that they film actually are porn stars.
Right.
And but they're not having sex with a stranger, and they're not having sex for the camera. They're making love with their life partner.
Right.
And so it's just a great opportunity to find out what even the porn stars do in their private lives when they're not acting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's such a nice educational curve, because I think it's easy to have this fantasy that those beautiful people are doing it this way.
Right.
And the rest of us are somehow or another having some kind of watered-down version of that. And it's like, no, the beautiful people in the pornographic films don't have sex that way either, because it wouldn't work.
Right. Well, and I think also, you know, how much does the physical perfection actually relate? Because I see so many women who are like, wow, I'm 10 pounds overweight, or I have one breast that's bigger than the other, or whatever it is for them.
Oh, my God, really?
Oh, my gosh, yeah, a ton. I mean, very,
they're
very
commonly.
They're
coming and talking about one breast being bigger than the other.
Well, that's actually, most women have one breast bigger than the other, but that's another.
Yeah,
it's
like our eyebrows are not the same level either. You know?
Right, well, exactly. And, you know, so many women are like, well, it's because of this or that or the other, I can never be good in bed. And, you know, I think what a lot of individuals really don't understand is that great sex is so much more than a physical identified experience, you know, just like you're referencing there, yes, technique and, you know, the what porn stars are doing manually to each other is really relevant, but there's so much more depth to the sexual experience that makes it a vital, sustainable experience. Because, you know, the pornography type, you know, spring break porn film is relevant in most people's lives for a very short period of time. You know, I think most of our referencing to sex and relationships, for that matter, is that 1 minute when you meet someone and fall in love and have hot, great sex, when the rest of our life is the 30, 40, 50 years after that. And nobody talks about that, you know, and that's where really amazing sex can happen in terms of how you develop the relationship and your emotional and physical and spiritual experience of sex. And there's just so much more to that than you can even ever watch on a film, no matter how great it is, right? So, I mean, sex is an individual journey, which is what I love about it. I think it's fantastic.
Yeah, it's one of the things that I tell in my workshops that lately I felt the need to say this every time I start a workshop, which is basically, you're not a machine.
Mm-hmm.
and you know, it's really surprising to me how many people will sometimes, you know, kind of look at me like, are you sure?
Yeah.
If you're looking for, like, you're going to push this button this many times or for that long, and then this is exactly what's going to happen every time, that's not how sex is. It's a very organic, intuitive process. It's different every time. It's supposed to be different every time.
Well, and it evolves over our lifetime. I mean,
it does.
You know, you have children, you get married, you go through menopause, you lose a job, a parent dies. I mean, these life events completely shape our sexual selves. And I think that's another really important conversation that we don't have in our culture. It's kind of like this, you know, ABC conversation that maybe we have when we get married, and then, you know, or whenever the birds and the bees conversation happens, and it's like, that's your information that you take with you. And there's so many life transitions, and it's a natural, as you said, organic process that it changes. And, you know, for women,
well,
I think
that's scary for people, because they think they're going to lose something. And one of the things that, you know, I want to share with people is that you don't have to lose anything. As a matter of fact, the whole idea of hoping that your sex life will be as good as it was when you're 50 or 60 as it was when you were 20, I think that's very depressing. You should be shooting higher than that.
No, absolutely. No, and
you should hope that your sex life at 60 would be a hell of a lot better than it was at 20.
And a lot of patients tell me that, and I love to hear that. And statistics, there's data even that shows women postmenopausal will report having a most satisfying sexual experience that they have ever had. And a lot of the reasons are that they're like, I know what I'm doing now. You know, I'm comfortable in my body. I mean, so many of my teenage and 20-something patients actually have the highest amount of sexual dysfunction because they're so self-conscious and so concerned and uncomfortable in their body and uneducated that, you know, they aren't having anywhere near the amount of fun that everybody thinks they are.
No,
even with
I certainly know I wasn't.
Well, true, you know.
Time,
and
first
I think
time I had sex, that's nothing to remember or write home about, or, you know, it was pretty, actually it was just kind of painful.
Yeah. Well, and that's really, really common, you know. And so I think there's this illusion that when you're single or when you're in your 20s, which is another misconception. I mean, studies have shown us pretty over and over that the highest level of sexual satisfaction are in individuals who are partnered. And I think in our culture, we think, well, those Budweiser ads, that like 20-something single, you know,
right,
young thing is like having the best sex that there is to have in our culture. And that's just usually not the case, you know. And so
yeah.
I think working in sexuality is kind of slowly untangling this incredible web of misperceptions about what great sex is, which is fun some days, laborious others, right?
Yeah. Well, and also I think it's time to, you know, create more of a holistic approach to our sexuality so that it's connected to the other aspects of ourselves and
mm-hmm.
and not out there as something separate from the rest of our lives, which unfortunately that's where a lot of people are still, you know, they talk about every aspect of their life and every aspect of their life is connected except for the sex. The sex is over there in a corner somewhere all by itself.
Well, and it's true, you know, and I think that's also really exemplified by the fact that most relationship or marriage therapists never talk about sex even, you know. All these people who we think would be integrating into a holistic perspective, gynecologists, urologists, marriage therapists, all of them are excluding sex. And it's really interesting because I completely 100% agree. I mean, it's all connected, which is why I find it to be such a fascinating aspect to specialize in medicine, because I feel like a sexual function has a window into so many other areas of our lives in terms of our physical health, because there are so many illnesses that do affect our sexual function. And, you know, our physical state of health and wellness is really important. And yet our emotional experience and our even our spiritual experience is all equally relevant. And, you know, and individuals who I see who have a really vital experience of sex have some cogs in the wheel of those three pieces in motion at some point in time, you know. And yeah, maybe sometimes people have really great just porn style sex and that's fantastic, and maybe other times they have a very emotional connection and a very intimate experience and that's okay too, you know. But as you said, it's organic and shape shifting constantly.
Mm-hmm, it really is. And of course, as you know, I believe that once we can extricate our sexuality from this shame,
yeah,
if we could all be in the shame-free zone, it'll probably lead us to being a less violent society.
I agree. I mean, I think we spend such a bizarre amount of time in our culture talking about sex, but in all these really bizarre, estranged ways. We're not actually talking about what it really is or what it really can be, and we're definitely not giving people tools. And so it's a very hypersexual experience to be in our culture, and yet very isolating, and that's a really bizarre combination, you know. It's like sex is everywhere, but nobody's talking about it for real, and
yeah,
you know, and it's so confusing for people. And I mean, I have my patients all day long are just like, it's so perplexed, you know. Well, I think I should be doing this, or I think, you know, and there's a really common, very, very common, it's like, well, I'm having this experience of I don't want to have sex, or it's painful, or I'm having erectile problems, but nobody else is having the same problem. I'm the only one that does, because we don't talk about sex in a very realistic way. And the fact of the matter is that sexual concerns are extremely common in our culture, and a lot of what any individual experiences, you know, I try to reassure them, I guarantee you there are many, many other people who are experiencing the same thing in their closed door in their bedroom. And I think the more we can kind of open that dialogue, the healthier our culture can be around sex. And, you know, we've come a long way, right?
Absolutely. Even those of us who specialize in sexuality will encounter issues over the course of a lifetime.
Oh, absolutely. We're all human.
I personally like to use that journey to help inform and educate my clients. You know, it's like, why would I want to, like, pretend that everything's perfect? It's not.
Mm-hmm.
There are always going to be obstacles. And what's great to me, though, if you can keep an open mind, if life presents you with something, whether that's menopause or childbirth, something that's maybe created a little shift in your hormones or your sexual desire, that if you work with that, and, you know, it may be that you're going to have to try to up your game around exercise or diet, you might have to go back and work on some suppressed emotions. whatever that journey entails, that you can not only reclaim what you might feel like you lost, but that you could actually catapult yourself into another area where you would exceed any of your wildest dreams about what's possible.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, that is where this type of work becomes so rewarding, right, is when you do have the honor, I consider it an honor, to be witness to that process for someone. And
yeah.
I find a lot of the time, one of the big pieces of my job is just to hold that beacon of light for someone and to say, this is possible to get to become different and to become better. And it's really common when you have a sexual concern, especially if it has been in existence for a very long time, that it's always been this way, it will always be this way,
will
never get better. And the fact of the matter is,
it's a self-perpetuating prophecy. You know, we're out of time, Serena. This has been a great conversation. I hope we can do it again, but I'm going to actually have to sign off for tonight.
Well, it was fabulous talking with you, and thanks again for having me on the show.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thanks. Again, my guest tonight was Serena McKenzie, and next week I will have David Steinberg, a man who photographs sex, on the show. He's also a very good friend of mine. Hope you'll join us then. Good night.
Thank you for tuning in tonight. If you liked what you heard and you want more solutions for your love life, please call me toll-free at 888-903-0050. Once again, that number is 888-903-0050. I am the only person who answers that line, and I am usually available Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also visit sexwithoutshame.com to discover more of what I can do for you. And remember, your secret is safe with you. Sering kesepian, kenapa tak menutup kabar berita?